Hello and welcome to Health Check from the BBC World Service. I'm Claudia Hammond and this is the show where we dissect the latest health news to ask what it means for us. Which breakthroughs is it early days for and what could make a real difference to people's health now? Now, in every episode, a guest from the world of health helps me to get to grips with what's happening. And today I have a new guest, Dr. Ike Anya. He's a consultant in public health medicine working in Nigeria and in the UK, where he's an honorary lecturer at Imperial College London. And if you're someone who never misses an episode of Health Check, you may remember him from a couple of months ago when he came in to talk to us about his memoir, Small by Small, about his years training to be a doctor in Nigeria. Well, welcome back to Health Check. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Claudia.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, later on, we're going to be talking to you about how strength training might improve your memory if you have dementia. And I want to ask you about new research on sleeping sickness too. But we are starting with sickle cell disease after new figures published in The Lancet show that more than 10 times as many people die with the disease than previously thought. And a Lancet commission is calling for governments around the world to take action. So can I ask you, Ike, to explain, first of all, what sickle cell disease is?
So sickle cell disease is a condition or a group of conditions where there is an abnormality in the gene that produces hemoglobin, which is the chemical that carries oxygen in our blood. So if someone with what's called the trait, where one of the genes has this problem, marries someone who also has that trait, there's a possibility that they have a child with sickle cell disease, which then manifests itself as painful episodes with the arms and legs swelling up, what are called crises, which happen from time to time, which are caused by the malformed red blood cells blocking the blood vessels and leading to very severe pain and sometimes kidney failure or eye disease or other problems.
And why is it a disease that affects so many people in Africa and also people with African-American heritage generally?
The belief is that the sickle cell trait helps protect against severe malaria. And so it's believed that in those parts of the world, particularly West Africa, where malaria was endemic, that this developed as an evolutionary way of dealing with it. But of course, the side effect is that you then have people who have the full-blown disease who are actually at more risk of malaria.
Now, the last time we talked about sickle cell disease on Health Check, we were looking at a kind of brand new cutting-edge treatment using gene editing. But what is the usual treatment that people can have?
They'll have pain relief. They'll have blood transfusions to help get the blood flowing again. But for cure, very expensive, not available in low and middle income countries, you have what's called stem cell transplant, where a sibling of the person, if they match, they can take the marrow and transplant it into the person with sickle cell, and then they are cured. So there is also the treatment called hydroxyurea, which has been shown to be effective in dealing with sickle cell as well.
And people can actually end up dying, though, can't they, from sickle cell disease, especially babies?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the vast majority of people in certainly West Africa with sickle cell disease will die before they are five. And then of the rest, very few will make it into late adulthood.
Now, these new figures are suggesting that the disease might be implicated in the deaths of 10 times as many people as was previously thought. How come the estimate is so much larger now than it was?
I mean, I think, first of all, I'd say that it's not surprising that it's been shown to be much larger, because I am Nigerian, and growing up in Nigeria, virtually every Nigerian will know someone who has sickle cell disease. That's how common it is. Unfortunately, the actual systems of recording are poor. And that's what's really interesting about this study, because what they've done is take the sort of limited recording that there is and then try to use interesting ways of calculating it by looking at, in countries of the world where they have good systems of recording, how does that compare? And, you know, sort of calculating that if this is what it is in this country with this number of people, this is what it probably is altogether. And they are looking at things like deaths from kidney failure, which is a result of sickle cell disease, and other things like that.
And so as a result, the Lancet Commission is calling for better care. And in a moment, we're going to hear what's being done in Jamaica. But before that, I want to introduce you to Leah Kalenga-Bay. She lives in Kenya, and because her older sisters had sickle cell disease, she was screened as a baby and diagnosed when she was just 6 months old. Her parents were told she wouldn't live beyond her teens. But now, in her 30s, she has founded the Africa Sickle Cell Organization to campaign for other people with the disease. And she told me how it's affected her life.
It has affected it in both good ways and bad ways. The worst of the symptoms of sickle cell is pain. Being able to live with the chronic pain, recovering from that pain and knowing that you will eventually get it again gives you a form of post-traumatic stress disorder that you need to manage, especially when you grow older. However, when we were younger, we didn't know what sickle cell was. Like, I didn't know what sickle cell was until I was in sixth grade. There was a boy who brought out that my eyes were different, my body was different, and therefore I had something that was contagious and told everyone to stay away from me. So that was very, very stigmatizing for me at that age because I didn't know why I was being treated that way. And that's when my parents told me that I had sickle cell. And of course, it made me see myself differently. It made me see myself as less than. And also, it made me aware of all the things that my sisters and our family experienced that I was not aware of. For example, my mother shielded us a lot from things like negative names from the neighbors who did not understand the condition that we lived with. And as we grew older, we had to understand how to manage our symptoms. Like, what do we do that triggered sickle cell crisis? So we had to really be intentional with the food that we ate, the medicines that we took, the sports. Me and my sister do not know how to swim because largely we were not allowed to swim because of sickle cell. So we're learning now at this very old age.
You're learning to swim now. That's quite hard, isn't it?
Yes.
That's hard later.
Yes. Yeah. So it was bad because we really had to rebuild our self-esteem in that sickle cell is not all that we are. Sickle cell is not a bad thing. Sickle cell is solvable. So once we got over the stigma and the discrimination that we experienced, is now we began to accept ourselves and live our full lives.
And how much help is there for people with sickle cell disease in Kenya?
Well, it depends where you're at, Georgia, you see. So for sickle cell care is centralized in the cities, in the urban cities like Nairobi, Mombasa, and Kisumu, where there's private hospitals, where you have to be wealthy to pay these exorbitant costs to access this care. But if you're in the rural area, depending on the rural area that you are, you will either get a situation where the doctor does not understand what you have, there are no diagnostics to tell the doctors what you have, there is no medicines to treat what you have, there is no blood and blood component. So it is, you are misdiagnosed over and over again. By the time you're diagnosed correctly, there is no medicines or there is no healthcare practitioner who understands your disease. So they send you miles away to go to Nairobi, where you have to pay a lot of transport costs, a lot of costs to pay for that medicine, a lifelong condition, Claudia. This is what people go through, especially in rural, resource-poor communities.
And the Lancet Commission is calling on governments to provide better care. What changes would you like to see to improve the situation?
Better care is contextualized care, meaning, depending on where you are, let's have the basic minimums for sickle cell. If we can be able to get early diagnostics and early referral to care and availability of this care, I think that is better because currently the status quo is that there are very few countries across sub-Saharan Africa that have implemented widespread newborn screening. And two, no country in Africa has a sickle cell policy that tells us what's what for sickle cell. Yes, we have guidelines for management, but do we have a comprehensive policy for sickle cell? No.
That's interesting that you mentioned screening of babies, because we've been speaking to doctors in the Caribbean who've rolled out a screening program so that babies can be treated earlier. So is that the kind of intervention you'd like to see?
If you do not reach these patients early enough, they end up experiencing a lot of complications and a lot of infections very early on. Widespread newborn screening allows us to address, identify very early and link to care. Secondly, it completely puts us in a different playing field where we have the data to justify and to make an investment case for sickle cell across sub-Saharan Africa. Without data, without understanding how to generate this data, understand this data, distribute this data, we are not having the conversations with the people who have the money to make the change that we need for this condition in sub-Saharan Africa.
And what is the situation now with the disease for you? What treatment do you receive for the condition?
I am more privileged than the ones that we support. I have access to hydroxyurea. I have access to any kind of comprehensive care that I may need, but I don't actually need at the moment. But I still face the challenge of accessing care affordably, okay? Because healthcare insurance for sickle cell in Kenya is very difficult to find. In most cases, they chase you away because this is a pre-existing condition. So for me, I still pay out of pocket, unfortunately. But we have managed as the organization, Africa Sickle Cell Organization, to raise funding, to pool money together to provide care for 300 patients now at the primary healthcare level. That is something.
So what else could be done in practice to improve care? In Jamaica, decades of research have led to a program where pregnant women and newborn babies are screened for sickle cell disease, and there is free medication for those attending a special sickle cell unit. Jennifer Knight Madden contributed to the Lancet Commission. She's Professor of Paediatric Pulmonology and Clinical Research at the University of the West Indies. And she told me why this region of the world became such a centre for research.
The Caribbean has persons who came both from Africa and from India. And as a result, we have sickle cell disease in our gene pool right across the region. So there's been research into sickle cell disease going back into the 50s. And in the 60s, when Professor Sargent came, he joined an ongoing program and was able to do the Jamaica sickle cell cohort study with his wife, Mrs. Beryl Sargent. And they screened 100,000 consecutive regular births, non-operative births, and identified approximately 500 people with sickle cell disease who've been followed up now into their 40s. And there are two sort of seminal lessons that came out early. One was about acute splenic sequestration. So the spleen is the cousin to the liver. It's on the left side, the liver is on the right. And that's what takes out the dead red cells, but it also is very important in fighting infection. But because these cells are so sticky and they stick to each other, that happens in the spleen. And you can get a sudden acute sequestration, which means all the blood sticks into the spleen. And the baby goes from running around one day to dead the next. And that used to be the commonest cause of death in babies with SS less than 2 years of age. And what came out of the study was by simply teaching the parents to feel the tummy every day. And if the spleen wasn't felt yesterday and it's felt today, you take the baby right to the doctor or hospital where they can get blood if necessary and have the spleen that isn't working anyway removed after 2 episodes. We've gotten to the point now where it's very rare to have a baby die from that problem. The second thing was that the spleen is also important in infections. So a special kind of bug called encapsulated, it means it has a capsule that makes it really hard to kill. And so the spleen was really important, was not being killed in babies with sickle cell disease. As a result, pneumococcus infections are much more in babies who have not been on treatment. And so this is a bad bug. It causes meningitis, inflammation on the brain, infection in the lungs, infection in the blood. And it was one of the commonest causes of death in early life and throughout life in people with sickle cell disease. And because the babies had been identified, and they were given vaccines against this, as well as started on penicillin. Between those two things, deaths in babies with sickle cell disease by the time they reach the age of 5 has gone from 20% in the early cohort to being no more than the other children born without sickle cell disease in Jamaica now. So that's a tremendous improvement using extremely cheap things: vaccines, penicillin, and teaching the parents to feel the tummy. Now, with ongoing research into things like the use of hydroxyurea and so on, we expect even better survival, as it is already. Most of our patients are making it into adulthood. We even have patients living to their 90s. I remember some years ago, this gentleman came to clinic looking very dapper in his bow tie and his vest because it was his 90th birthday. And there was a little girl in clinic. It was her 9th birthday. So we sent out, we got a cake. We had a celebration of life of people living with sickle cell disease.
Oh, that's nice. Jennifer Knight Madden on how simple interventions can make a difference. And IK, she also said to us that what you need is to have good research and the doctors and patients like Lair who campaign if you really want to make a difference. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And, you know, I must say how heartening it is to hear this call for more resources and these initiatives, because as Professor Madden said, these are very simple, cheap interventions. And I think that's why it's important that the voice of patients as well is heard very loudly and we start counting the number of people more accurately so that resources can be made available.
You are listening to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond and my guest today is public health consultant IK Anya. Now, IK, I wanted to ask you about sleeping sickness because there's new research in the journal Science this week and it's from the University of Glasgow in Scotland. So first of all, what is sleeping sickness and how do you get it?
So sleeping sickness is also called human African trypanosomiasis, and there's also the American version called Chagas disease, caused by a parasite called the trypanosomes, and they are transmitted by usually insects bite. They cause pain, fevers, and swollen lymph nodes in the early stages, and in much later stages affect the central nervous system with disturbed sleeping patterns, which is why it's called sleeping sickness.
And it's very serious, isn't it?
It is very serious. Without treatment, 100% mortality.
And it is early days with this new research in Glasgow, but what have they found?
Well, it's quite interesting. They found a new compound, a new chemical that they think is very effective against the trypanosomes. And it's really exciting news because for a very long time, no new drugs have been discovered to work. Some of the drugs being used have been used since the Second World War. And that was partly because this disease affects poor rural Africans and Latin American communities. And so there wasn't much incentive for research into these drugs.
And there are some attempts as well to let the public know more about this disease. And in Malawi, there's a new project, which is also from Glasgow University. And they are trying to tell people about how the disease is transmitted. And they're using street theatre. And we've got a bit we can listen to here. Now, what's happening is here that there's an empty container on a lorry and there are performers on stage there. There are people dressed in white doctor's coats and they've got giant nets on sticks and they're kind of catching these giant balls. And then there's somebody dressed up as a huge tsetse fly.
What struck me was how entranced the whole crowd there seemed to be by the activity. And I think anything that raises awareness about how this disease is transmitted and how people can protect themselves is useful and helpful. And so, yes.
What can people do to protect themselves?
Well, I think it's about understanding how the disease is transmitted. So, for instance, you know, protecting yourself against insect bites. It's also being aware of the early symptoms and seeking treatment as soon as possible.
Thanks very much, IK. Now to a very different disease, Alzheimer's, and a way of reducing the isolation that some people with dementia can feel. Side by Side is a new project led by the Alzheimer's Society in the UK, where volunteers are paired up with people living with dementia. And this is how David met Simon, who learned he had Alzheimer's disease during the COVID-19 lockdown. Now, I went to visit Simon and his wife, Ruth, at their home in Bristol to find out from Simon how it all works.
I would like to record my deep appreciation of David's friendship and kindness to me. I can't put it in words strongly enough. He's been a wonderful companion to me. He's helped me to see the enjoyment and best in life. He has enabled me to manage my diagnosis, and I cannot thank him enough for his willingness to support my reaching out to stay in the world.
David, what's it like hearing all that? What lovely words to be said about you and this scheme.
It is a wonderful scheme. What's really lovely about it is that we all benefit. I've made two lovely friends who I might not have met otherwise. And I can only thank the Alzheimer's Society. We have a great time, but it's not a big deal. It's just two old blokes hanging out together, having fun. And we go on trips and we go out for coffee and we eat lots of brownies. I think so many volunteering things, you feel you've kind of got to be rather worthy and, you know, it's going to be a big effort. And I feel a bit of a fraud in a way with this because it's such fun.
It sounds as though they've matched you up very well. Simon, do you have quite similar interests?
We get on very well.
You're a lot
other.
More erudite than me. Let's be honest. No, I mean, you're much more cultured. Hopefully some of that rubs off a little bit on me. Sometimes we're chatting and sometimes we're in companionable silence and, you know, it's just... but always in pursuit of coffee and brownies.
So you're heading out for a walk now.
Oh.
New hat.
Yeah.
Very nice. Like a nice cap. So you've got a list on the door here. Is this a sort of reminder list?
It's a reminder list, yes. So we have to go through cap.
Got the cap.
Good. Have you got your wallet,
you want that?
Simon? Have you got the house keys?
Check. Sun cream.
Brilliant. So then you've got everything on the list.
You've
ready
got
to head off.
On the list, you can go.
See you later.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye, Ruth. There's quite a nice cafe down there.
Okay, let's
down
head
the road. So
let's head that way.
And hang out. It's glorious, isn't it?
It's a lovely day today. And what about in winter? Because obviously it's a lovely sunny day today. But what about in winter?
We've had a few soakings, haven't we?
Yes, we have. We've got a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, we battle on. We've got to earn the brownie.
And David, what made you want to get involved with this scheme in particular?
I'd started to become interested in the whole area of dementia for two main reasons. One was that one of my retirement jobs is I conduct funerals. I'm a funeral celebrant.
Oh, wow.
And so I come in touch with a lot of families who've been struggling with dementia in elderly relatives. And the other was seeing and then taking part in productions of this amazing play, The Father, by Florian Zeller. Which,
oh, is that the same as the film?
It's
yes,
exactly,
I've seen the film. Yeah. Yes, the film's got Anthony Hopkins.
That's the one.
And it's kind of seen from his point of view, and it's confusing, and the rooms change.
It draws you in, doesn't it? So I thought, I wonder if there's any way that, as a volunteer, you can do anything in this world.
I think it's made us both much more positive. It's something really that we both look forward to. And it's made us see the joy of life, actually, that life hasn't come to an end. And that's, I think, is so important with something like Alzheimer's.
Is that quite a contrast with how it felt at the beginning?
Oh, at the beginning, it was so hard. It was so lonely. And, you know, you'd have people saying, well, you're all right, Ruth, because you're very strong, you'll be able to cope. And you feel like saying, do you know what? I'm just like everybody else. And it's awful. And it was virtually a year since, after Simon's diagnosis, that we met David. It just gave us hope. It was like a ray of sunshine coming into our lives again.
And what difference have you seen it make to Simon's mental health and to his mood, say?
It's much more cheerful.
Yes, yeah. I mean...
Simon's memory isn't as good as it was. But he does know when it's Monday, and he does know when David's coming.
That's interesting. So so also David's visits are almost sort of punctuating the week.
They're absolutely.
They're signalling this is the start of the week again.
Yes.
You know that Simon is with David and off doing something else. What do you then do during that time?
Perhaps sometimes I meet friends for coffee. Sometimes I'll do more mundane things. But on the whole, I don't have to think about anybody else. And when you're living with somebody with Alzheimer's, you're constantly aware that you've got to think not only of what he wants and what both of you need and want, and also what you want. So, you know, you've got very little time left actually for yourself. And these are a couple of hours just for me.
And is the plan that you will carry on visiting for years, maybe?
Yeah, if he'll have me.
Will you have him?
Absolutely.
Yeah, long may it continue.
Now, IK, I was interested to see that Simon and David were going out walking because, of course, there is evidence that exercise is very useful for people with dementia. And there's a new early study just out from Brazil, and I should warn you, it's only in mice so far, showing that doing strength training can reduce symptoms of dementia. What is this study?
So scientists are able to, if you like, induce Alzheimer-like illnesses in mice, and then they were able to get them to engage in the equivalent of strength training, and they found that those mice which did sort of had a slower onset of dementia than those that didn't. And as you say, it's early days yet.
Yeah, and that backs up other research on exercise that's already been done with people. And I think it's interesting because we're so used to thinking of dementia as something where your memory just gets worse and worse. And yet strength training, so this is anything where you make your muscles stronger, yeah, can actually make a difference and make improvements to your memory.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are other examples that are emerging of evidence that suggests that people can continue to learn new things even when they've got dementia. And I think it's important not to think of people with dementia as sort of blank canvases or empty vessels, but actually people who can still be active and use their minds in new ways.
Well, thank you so much, IK Anya, for joining us today. Thank you for listening to Health Check from the BBC. And thanks to the producer, Claire Salisbury, and our studio engineer today, Jackie Mardram. I'm Claudia Hammond, and in the next episode of Health Check, trials of a low-cost portable brain scanner. Could it one day be used in clinics around the world to save lives? Do join me if you can.